Just to catch up again, we've now seen two examples or two modes in which it seems that the presence of the active presence of God, the subtle presence of God, is brought out in the confessions. We saw first yesterday God being always there in everything that seems to happen, and this morning in the spontaneous prayers we feel God and Augustine talking together and praying together. The third way that I feel that God feels close within the pages is the desire for God that appears in Augustine all throughout the pages of the Confessions, the desire that he expresses so frequently. So far we have seen two ways by which the Confessions of St. Augustine contain a subtle presence of God and seem to bring God closer to us as we read them. One, Augustine's way of seeing God permeate into every corner of his life story, and two, the live conversations between Augustine and God that we find on so many of his pages. There's also a third way that the book makes God present, by highlighting the desire Augustine had for God. Bear with me for a moment as I try to describe this delicate touch of Augustine. As we read the Confessions, we become more and more aware of a deep yearning within Augustine for a union with God that comes out little by little as he writes the book. It appears immediately at the beginning when he made his famous statement, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." That restlessness is another way of speaking about the movement in him towards God that was created by his desire. We saw it again while talking about his spontaneous prayers, when he said, for example, "O justice and innocence, fair and lovely, it is on you that I want to gaze with eyes that see purely and find satiety in never being sated." The desire is particularly explicit in his spontaneous prayers. However, after reading a while, you begin to detect it less explicitly, but just as real in other parts of the book. The desire has become a constant glow, and something, sometimes even a fire, that pervades the whole work. Augustine says he longs to have God enter within him. He pines for peace and the truly happy life that comes when one is united with God. He chooses the beauty of God over the ugliness of the past. He's on a search for God that will never stop. A good example of this explicit desire within a spontaneous prayer comes in Book 7, when we read about how he first experienced God after taking St. Ambrose's advice to study the books of the Neoplatonic philosophers. First, he describes this experience. Again, we heard this last night with Father Ben's translation. "Being admonished by all this meaning the books he read, to return to myself, I entered into my own depths with you as guide. I entered, and with the eye of my soul, I saw your unchangeable light shining over that same eye of my soul, over my mind. It was not the light of every day that the eye of flesh can see, nor some greater light of the same order. Your light was not that, but altogether other than such lights. Nor was it above my mind as oil is above the water it floats on, nor as the sky is above the earth. It was above because it made me." So he's describing this first. Finally, he's able to enter within himself. As a product of his own age, He was not able to think of God in strictly spiritual ways. He always had God connected to the material. God was either the biggest, the strongest, the longest, the tallest, the highest, the oldest, but it was still always connected to the material. But these Platonic philosophers enabled him to think in pure spiritual terms. And then he went into himself. And he uses the image of a light, because he couldn't find any other word to say it. He's now told us that, but then he bursts into prayer. O eternal truth, and true love, and beloved eternity, you are my God. Here we go. I sigh to you by day and by night. He's writing about this. And then he goes again from the past. I went in, I saw you, to the present. It just says, I sigh to you by day and night. And we feel that. We just feel that yearning there. Another prayer of desire is at the beginning of the confessions, within a long opening meditation that sets the tone for the rest of the book. And he says, let me seek you then, Lord, even when I am calling upon you, and call upon you even as I believe in you. How shall I call upon my God and my Lord, when by the very act of calling upon him, I would be calling him into myself? Is there any place within me into which my God might come? How should the God who made heaven and earth come into me? Is there any room in me for you, Lord, my God? He goes on further, speaking of his desire in that same meditation. Who will grant me to find peace in you? Who will grant me this grace that you would come into my heart and inebriate it? The house of my soul is too small for you to enter. Make it more spacious by your coming. It lies in ruins. Rebuild it. Some things are to be found there which will offend your gaze. I confess this to be so and know it well. But who will cleanse my house? To whom but yourself can I cry, cleanse me of my hidden sins? He's asking God to come within him, but he says, my problem is, he uses the image, the house of my soul is too small. I always think, this is the house of my soul is like a fist. He says, you open it. It's in ruins. You rebuild it. It's got things about it that offend your gaze. You clean it. We can look again at the spontaneous prayer he wrote as he was narrating his final conversion at Milan to see the quality of desire it contains. He says, come, Lord, arouse us and call us back. Kindle us and seize us. Prove to us how sweet you are in your burning tenderness. Let us love you and run to you. Augustine's desire for God is very clear in these and other spontaneous prayers. It seems to have a certain transparency to it. It lets you see through and get a glimpse of who it is that Augustine is desiring. You could call it a trace of God, a hint of who is at the other side of Augustine's yearning. I like to think of it as the face of a coin that lets you see through to the face on the other side. In the Confessions, Augustine is constantly stretching himself out toward this God whom he had seen pervading his life and with whom he had been conversing. This reaching out by Augustine awakens our own desire for God as we continue to read on. Such was Augustine's desire as expressed in some of his spontaneous prayers. Let's look now at a less explicit instance of his desire. In Book 3, he describes his university life at Carthage. He said, I came to Carthage where a cauldron of illicit loves leapt and boiled about me. I was not yet in love, but I was in love with love. And from the very depth of my need, hated myself for not more keenly feeling the need. I sought some object to love, since I was thus in love with loving. And I hated security, and a life with no snares for my feet. This is the Augustine we have all heard about in his university days at Carthage, in love with loving, fascinated by new adventures, and heedless of risk. But then he goes further. For within I was hungry, all for the want of that spiritual food which is yourself, my God. Yet though I was hungry for want of it, I did not hunger for it. I had no desire whatsoever for incorruptible food, not because I had it in abundance, but the emptier I was, the more I hated the thought of it. He says, within I was hungry. What was he hungry for? He said, that spiritual food which is yourself, my God. For Augustine, everyone in the world has that hunger. Even a young African immersed in the cauldron of illicit loves of university life. Like many other young men, Augustine says, though I was hungry for want of it, I did not hunger for it. I prefer a more liberal translation. I say, I was hungry for it, but had no appetite. That would mean that he was completely unaware of this deep desire for God, because he was taken by so many of the things a young man of 18 is usually taken by. But it remains true, he said, nonetheless, that he was hungering even then. Hungering for God. That's another way of saying desiring God. There's other words. He uses the words like sighing. We saw sigh to sighing. Hungering, yearning, pining, desiring. All these he uses to describe himself, but at the same time, us. But as he does it, we tend to just get a trace of what he was hungering for, which is no small thing. As a conclusion, there is that famous prayer that comes after his conversion in Book 10. And you all, I'm sure you've heard this. But listen to it now from the point of view of desire. Late have I loved you, beauty so ancient and so new. Late have I loved you. Lo, you were within, but I outside, seeking there for you. And upon the shapely things you made, I rushed headlong, I misshapen. You were with me, but I was not with you. They held me back from you, those things which would have no being were they not in you. You called, shouted, broke through my deafness. You flared, blazed, banished my blindness. You lavished your fragrance. I gasped, and now I pant for you. There's another word, pant for you. I tasted you, and I hunger and thirst. You touched me, and I burn for your peace. This famous prayer could be considered a summary in poetic form of all that preceded in the Confessions. It speaks of his remorse over how long he had wandered. It repeats the wonderful ways God had of bringing him back. And it reflects Augustine's constant desire to rest in God. Now I pant for you. I tasted you, and I hunger and thirst. You touched me, and I burn for your peace. Augustine finishes by saying, I have burned for your peace. We find ourselves too burning for God's peace. I must say that this has been the most precious effect on me of reading the Confessions, or any part of them, even a paragraph. That same desire for God that Augustine felt so intensely, and which makes God so present amid the pages, I find myself carrying away with me as I close the book. So that's basic, the third part that I wanted to leave with you, this constant desire. Augustine goes on later in some of his homily, a lot of his homilies and his letters, to tell us that, I wish Father Ben were here because he could tell us more, often our best prayer is a prayer of desire, and frequently wordless. Our best prayer is when we can get deep into it. What is it I really, really want? But it takes a lot of living to find that out. It takes a lot of mistakes and coming back again. It takes a lot of pain, suffering, little by little. The daily life of love and loss, failure and success, disappointment and joy, it's kind of like a sifting process. Little by little, we have this question, what do I really desire? I desire many things. And some of those things are wonderful. Some aren't. But little by little, as we live, I think we all agree, true religion is for grown-ups who have tasted the school of hard knocks and lived it. It is for children too, but I think most of the time we're planting seeds so that in the future they'll have something to grasp onto it. But our life, this, as we saw here, things have taught us a lot. And one of the things that we learn is, what is it I really, really desire? And the prayer of desire is the prayer in which I kind of return to that and rest in my deepest desire for whatever amount of time I can do that. And we can use words in the beginning. That's kind of like a warm-up process. That's the way that the team goes out and runs and is before the game. But the real prayer begins when desire begins. I see it kind of like a candle, a lit candle, where the flame goes up and up and up as I just rest within that. But Father Ben could tell us a lot more about it. Maybe he did too yesterday, I don't know. But Augustine's desire is catching when we read the Confessions, especially when we read, feel his desire coming out of his story, and then say, wait, my desire comes out of my story, and take it from there. Okay, that's the end of the things I was going to say, but I just wanted to end with another thing because it struck me something interesting. Give you a little preparation just for this. You'll find this. The word praise is something I wanted to say. Augustine, I don't think I mentioned it. I mentioned it 3 years ago. The Confessions of St. Augustine are not the confessions of his sins. They're the confessions or professions of his gratitude and his praise. That's what Confessions means. I confess my praise to God. I confess my gratitude towards God. Anyway, we saw the opening lines of the Confessions where he says, a little part of your creation wants to praise you. He ends with praise too. But it's kind of interesting. Before I read this, I brought in from your library two of the other great famous books of Augustine, The City of God and The Work on the Trinity. And these books, all three books, end with a note of praise. Now the confession has 13 books in it. We have dealt with just 10, because that's where Augustine's story is. The last three books of the confessions are very different, extremely different. So I can consider at least Augustine's story as ending with the end of book 10. That's why I told you this. I forgot to put the citation down. It's book 10, chapter 43. And I just thought it'd be kind of interesting, a little hint to you. It doesn't really have to do with desire. It has to do with prayer. But I thought we had a little time. You might find that curious. I'm going to read to you the last three or four lines of the City of God, the last three or four lines of the De Trinitate, the Trinity, and this paragraph here. And then we'll look at this. This is very interesting to us. So let me just give you the City of God, the big book, by the way. But we're not going to read the rest. We're just going to read the last few lines. He's gone through all the history of salvation, the whole thing. And he says, the important thing is that the seventh day will be our Sabbath, whose end will not be an evening, but the Lord's day, an eighth day, as it were, which is to last forever. A day consecrated by the resurrection of Christ, foreshadowing the eternal rest, not only of the spirit, but of the body too. And these are the famous end lines. There we shall be still and see. We shall see and we shall love. We shall love and we shall praise. Behold what will be in the end without end. For what is our end but to reach that kingdom which has no end? This is how he ends this big book. But the idea of praise, I'll just say it again. We shall be still and see. We shall see and we shall love. We shall love and we shall praise. So that's one end. Then the Trinity, another big book, ends this way. So when we do attain to you, there will be an end to these many things which we say and do not attain. And you will remain one. Remember, he's talking about the Trinity, three, one, three. Yet all in all, and we shall say one thing, praising you in unison, even ourselves being also made one in you. So that's how he ends the Trinity, with praise. Us all, many of us, in unison, one in you. Now, let's look at how he ends these ten books of the Confessions. But I say it's kind of like ending the whole personal side of it. And I'm going to break, I will read it first and I'm going to break it down and show you some interesting things here. Terrified by my sins and the mass of my misery, I had pondered in my heart and thought of flight to the desert. In those days, there were a lot of monks fleeing to the desert, Antony of the desert in Egypt, etc. But you forbade me and strengthened me, saying, and Christ died for all, that they also who live may now not live to themselves, but with him who died for them. See, Lord, I cast my care upon you, that I may live. You know my unskillfulness and my infirmity. Teach me and heal me. He, your only one, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, has redeemed me with his blood. I think upon the price of my redemption. I eat it and drink it and give it to others to eat and drink. And being poor, I desire to be filled with it together with those that eat and are filled. And they shall praise the Lord that seek him." There's that praise again. Last line. I just want to break this down a little bit because it's kind of interesting because I didn't get into it. But in book 10, after his conversion, he tells us that his conversion is not over. He's still struggling, which really shouldn't be a surprise. Terrified by my sins, which he, of course, you know, saints call sins things that we would say are all right, because he was really going high. "I pondered in my heart the thought of flight to the desert." Have we ever thought of fleeing away from all this stuff? Do we ever find it possible? Probably not, but "I thought of flight to the desert, like many monks were doing," and this is the early days of the monastic life. "But you forbade me. You forbade me and strengthened me." This is very interesting. Augustine, after his conversion in Milan and his baptism there, went back to Africa. He quit his job. He had a very important position in the imperial court. He quit that. He headed back to Africa with a few other friends who were converted and baptized about the same time, African friends. And he and they started a life together in his hometown, Tagaste. In fact, they think it's probably in his own father's house. You know, Monica died on the way back. She was there, but she didn't make it to Africa. She died in Italy, in Ostia. And he started living a life there, he said, of prayer, study, and service. And he loved that. But, you probably know this story too, he got caught, tricked into becoming a priest. he knew he was getting quite famous. People were very attracted to him. When he would go out, he would always avoid going into a local church that was looking for a bishop, because he knew that they would, because the people elected their bishops in those days. They went and did it together. So he went out looking, he's going to a friend to bring back to become a member of their monastery. They were all laymen, in prayer, and he went by the town of Hippo, which had its bishop. What he didn't know was the bishop's language was Greek, and he didn't know much Latin, and he was looking for a priest to be his voice. And he went into church, and people were discussing it, and they saw Augustine, they grabbed him, and they forced him to become a priest. And his life totally changed from then on. Then he ordained a priest, and then eventually made the bishop, and the famous Augustine. So, "But you forbade me." This is a short word, he says that. "And but you strengthened me. So I can no longer just have my quiet, contemplative life. Saying, and Christ died for all, that they also who live may now not live to themselves, but with him who died for them." And the idea of Christ died for all, and you're being called for them. "I cast my care upon you that I may live. You know my unskillfulness, my teach me and heal me. He, your only one, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, has redeemed me with his blood. I think upon the price of my redemption, and now I eat it and drink it, and give it to others to eat and drink." The Eucharist. Somebody asked me yesterday, "Are we going to talk about the Eucharist at all?" I forget who it was that asked me. And I said, well, I wasn't really planning to go into Augustine's theology of the Eucharist, but here's something very interesting. Remember, the man who's writing the Confessions is a bishop. Just recently, but his life has been totally turned around, and he cried when they made him become a priest, because he was going to have to give up all of this. I eat it and drink it, and give it to others to eat and drink. It's very interesting how he's at the very end of his book, he's saying that. He is a minister of the Eucharist, of the salvation. He doesn't say the Eucharist, but because he weaves into a broader picture. And being poor, I desire to be filled with it. Here's the desire back again. To be filled with it. And listen to this. Be filled with it together with those that eat and are filled. Not alone, but with the other Christians. He's not just, I am giving them to eat and drink of the body and blood of Christ. I am with them in eating and drinking the body of Christ. Very much like the famous passage from the homily he wrote at the anniversary of his being elected a bishop. He says, for you I am a bishop, with you I am a Christian. The first terrifies me, the second consoles me. That's very similar here. I think a lot of people skip over this. They don't catch that. It's only a few words. Being poor, I desire to be filled with it. The food, the body and blood of Christ, the price of our redemption, together with those that eat and are filled. We were talking yesterday, I think, about Augustinian education was preparing people for others. The Jesuit idea, preparing people for others. The Augustinian is preparing people to be with others. Just these are little hints there that I said, closing the book, so maybe you just could go right over this. So I thought maybe give it. I don't connect it to the desire, and I can connect it to the presence of God, because God seems present right in this passage too. Seems quite at, first of all, Augustine's praying to him in the present directly. But he's also talking about his own self. And then we have the presence of the Eucharist, we have the desire, and we have Augustine saying, all right, you've set me out to be your minister, and I will do it. And then he ends the book, which he began the book talking about praise, and he ends it, and they shall praise the Lord that seek him. And I think that he means we, because he's just talked about being together with the others. So it's very kind of curiosity. And that connection, that in the Trinity, he ends with praise. In the City of God, he ends with praise. And the 10th book of the Confession, which I say is like a complete thing, he ends with praise. So that's, we've come to know Augustine better, I think.
In the desert, he talked about what it really means. The desert, is it referring to populated or unpopulated? Or is it is the community in which was around him? That was the
I don't know.
Oasis.
No, he's not talking about an oasis. I think he uses the idea of a desert as an image more than anything else.
Yes.
But there were the desert fathers had preceded him by just a little, the original desert fathers, but there was still quite a movement in Egypt and other places of people leaving everything, going out and living very extreme kind of life, and he felt tempted to do that, or the temptation would be just to stay where he was, because the life he was living was not a desert, but it was a strictly protected life of prayer and study. And he did service to others, but always I could kind of control things myself. I could come back. But once he became a priest, and more so when he became a bishop, he really had no more control over his peace and his life as far as an exterior way. That's what I think. But the image, and there's a psalm. I forget what psalm number it is. Oh, I could only flee away like a bird into the desert or into the mountain. I forget what it is. But of course, the psalmist is being ironic. He says, I can't. I have to stay where I am and face it.
On the wall in the chateau is the picture of the hermit leaves because the bread is too hard.
Yes.
I cannot go on. And he goes out into the woods. He meets Christ. And Christ says, if your bread is too hard, dip it into my wound.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if the person who drew that, read that.
Could be. Yep, go back.
Mm-hmm.
But go back,
go back.
With strengthened by the, how does he say it? Yes, strengthened, saying Christ died for all, and they also that they also may live, not for themselves, but for him who died for them. Yeah. So the blood, even the image of blood, is there.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do we know how long Saint Augustine pondered on becoming a priest and a bishop? Because it was difficult, wasn't it?
Yes, he. I mean, I think he had to say yes or no right away. But they really forced it on him. But he did ask the bishop to allow him some time. I don't know how much time. He felt he was not that well versed in the scriptures because he had only been converted a short time. And he asked the bishop for time away to really sink himself into the scriptures. And the bishop said yes. But as far as you know, it wasn't like, say, a young man today. Do I want to be a priest or not? It was like they had him by the shirt. You know, things were different in those days.
Was that the same with Ambrose?
Yes, it was. It was quite. In fact, Ambrose had not even been baptized yet. He came from a very important Roman family, high up in the society, and he had the important position of whatever it was called, but. Military, civil protector of Milan, what have you. And yes, the people said Ambrose. But he had never been baptized. But we have to remember that things were different in those days. And I've just read something recently that it was probably a family decision not to get baptism until a certain time. I didn't quite understand that. But yes, and that, there's a lot of cases of that. In those days, I think we have to remember probably also that there was more familiarity. That the Christians weren't everybody, and they kind of knew each other. And
this reluctance of him to accept the priesthood immediately as he was asked, was it, and he declined from Moses. Is that is it a moment of test, further test his vocation to see whether he was strong enough, or where he was to accept the priesthood.
Yeah, I don't know whether they, you know, we have the word vocation, God calls you and all that. I don't know whether they thought in those terms in those days. I guess it would be God's will. You know, these people have expressed themselves. I would say, in most cases, from us, our. For instance, if I were to get a message, would you accept to be a bishop? I would pretend I never got the letter. I would do everything I could to.
When in the church did that end?
Hmm?
When in the church did that end? You know, electing your own bishop. When did that suddenly?
I don't really know too well, but I bet it wasn't too much longer after that.
No.
Because it got more and more organized. You know, and I bet there have been some historical monographs on that, but I don't really know. I just know that that was the case with Ambrose and Augustine and others. Alypius became a bishop, but we don't know the story of that, whether he was forced to become a bishop or whether, I don't know.
But didn't Augustine want to stay in community? And
yes.
I felt this would be a pull away from community.
That's right. He cried.
Mm.
He wasn't allowed to keep a community, to live in, to have a community.
As a priest, he was. Yes.
Bishop.
Well, it was impossible. As a bishop, he had to receive all these official people, and they said that would have wreaked havoc on the religious community. So that's when he wrote the rule. But he kept a community. They lived in a community, but it was with his priests. I don't know whether they had the word diocesan priests in those days. But he made them all put everything in common. But he left the other community, that where they were mostly laymen, and he left them rule. But he said, I really couldn't keep this up. And, you know, the rule if you want to put it in a nutshell, it's basically coming together to search for God together and to serve God together. And a great emphasis on the unifying power of love, et cetera, et cetera. But in the bishop's house, where it was pretty important, it was a port city, and he said it would have wreaked havoc on them. So he kept up the essential of about putting all things in common, and I'm at celibacy, I'm quite sure, and whatever, but it was different. It wasn't that he stayed a monk, but there were a lot of bishops in those days that had been taken from monastic life and kept the monastic life as much as they could, with all the requirements made on them.
But didn't he later on, as bishop, say, well, it's good to be in community, but it's even better to serve, or words to that effect?
Don't know. Well, he did. Now, what he said, I think it was in his book on the works of the monk, he said, if I had really had my way, I would have stayed back where I was and with work and prayer and study. But I don't believe that myself. I kind of think that Augustine had a very pastoral heart. That the thing that made him say, oh, all right, was his pastoral heart.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yes.
Can I ask you something about this quotation, book 10, chapter 43? You said it was, I eat and drink it, and give to others food to drink, and you said that was the Eucharist.
I would think so,
yes,
yeah.
But he's talking about wisdom and knowledge in the previous sentence. Do you think he could be saying to share that with other people?
Oh, sure. Absolutely, that's good. It's a good thing you pointed out. Yes. All the treasures, hidden treasures. Yes, yes. We have this series of all the works of Augustine, and the first volume of all of Augustine's homilies on John's Gospel has come out. And my brother and friend Alan Fitzgerald wrote the introduction to it, and he had a very interesting insight. He says, if you read these homilies of Augustine on John, you hear him telling the people, let's try to understand this together. Now, obviously, Augustine would be the brightest light of all of them, because which is something I'm going to tell you tomorrow about homilies and things. The people in his local church were everyday people, just like any cross-section. But there are a couple times, and Alan pointed out very well, he said, he come up to quite an abstruse thing that John said, John could be abstruse, and he would say, let's look at this together and see if something, we can find something to come out of it. Alan said this was not just a literary mannerism. It was like, he says, I don't know what it means. It's so mysterious, but maybe we can, together, find something out of it. Let's journey together through John, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Not just, I've got the answer, and sit back and I'll tell you. In a lot of cases, of course, it was that way. But in other cases, he says, let's journey together through this, because it's so mysterious. Wait a minute. What in the world did he mean?
He also talks about the people who have the knowledge waiting for the people who haven't,
mm-hmm.
Not to catch up exactly, but to support them and to bring them along.
Yeah.
And that you have to be, if you do know something, pass it on. Be patient, mm-hmm. but everybody needs to know this.
And it's not a question of wanting to feel I know more than other people,
which
a lot of times in the academic world can be, it can be terrible. But it's like, yeah, I think that rings a bell. I think he does that. You know, another beautiful thing in the Trinity, I just love this. In the introduction, he said, now, I'm going to do this, I'm going to take on trying to go into the Trinity. He says, some of the things I write may be mistaken. If they are, God will correct them, either through a direct inspiration or through conversation with the brethren. Isn't that interesting? I love that. When I came upon that, I said, and I went back to the Latin to make sure that that's really what he said. And it seems to be. Isn't that wonderful? Here's this guy writing this unbelievable book that has gone down in history, and Father von Babel said, the only work of Augustine that has been translated into Greek is the De Trinitate. The Greeks weren't a bit interested in Augustine, still aren't. But this, yes, very interesting. And all these things, for us, you know, whether we're going to understand what's all in here, in the Trinity, or not, but we're getting an insight into Augustine, these little things that come out. And I think that's probably enough. That's what we need. Now, if you really want to study the book on the Trinity and get through, you'll learn even a lot more about Augustine, a lot more about the Trinity. But I read it once. I don't know how I got through it. I read this once too. I don't know how I got through that.
We had that in Rome, didn't we? With the lay city of God, mm-hmm. with Father Hems from the Jesuit priest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, there were two of them, and they took us, one who took us through that. And I wanted to ask, was it John that friends of Augustine studied? Augustine on John?
We did John's letters.
Oh, John's letters.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a bit shorter, mm-hmm. and but they're all wonderful. So tomorrow I'm going to tell you a little. I'll just give you a preview. I'm going to tell you about Augustine and his preaching, and then I'm going to show you a practice that I think you could do. We'll do it tomorrow, and then maybe you could continue doing it if you like it. Of getting you into Augustine. And what I did was I put together. I had it on my computer, and today we printed up. I think it's homily 68 we probably will not be able to finish because it's too long, but you can take it home with you. But you'll see the techniques I like to use, and his imagery and stuff like that. And I have found it's a wonderful way for, if you're getting together for a monthly meeting or whatever, a wonderful way of praying and discovering Augustine. You'll be Augustine the preacher more than Augustine the man undergoing a conversion, but that's the other half of his life. So, yeah. So that's what we're going to do.